got bad. Now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air, listener support community radio station WFT. Broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employee Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. Yes, we're going to be having, first of all, let you know who's in the studio today besides myself, Gus Wood, Bill Gorrell, and Angela Bingham is joining us again. And primarily today we're going to be focusing on Gus's kind of report about what's happening in Atlanta right now and also what's happened there in the recent past, maybe even the distant past. So definitely stay tuned to that. We're going to be starting here with some news stories. So Gus, what's been happening here in the last week?
Well, of course, this is 2015 is the year that the masses awaken about what's going on with systemic police brutality. So one of the things that I've been making sure that we keep in mind is the statistics that are going on in the country. So right now, as of June 13th, the number of people killed by police so far this year top 500 this week as the 500 as the nationwide epidemic of the violence continues. Here's the stat that will break people though. Cops have killed 20 people over the past 7 days alone.
That's three a day.
That's almost three people a day. That's beyond nadir numbers. For those that don't know, the nadir was 1890 to 1930, where black people were killed once every 36 hours between those year that year period by private white violence and also state sponsored violence as well. So yeah, we're now at almost three a day going on in the past, especially in the past 7 days, 1 week.
And that incident, even though no one was killed, thank God, that incident in McKinney, Texas, with that cop, I mean, pushing that 14-year-old girl in a bathing suit down, mm-hmm. and then some of her friends running up and saying, what the heck are you doing? What's, quit doing that. His response, he pulls out his gun, mm-hmm. And starts chasing him. I mean, it's like, and this guy was a trainer.
And that's the thing too, that we don't get every story that happens exactly. with police brutality. We get the murders and we get the sensationalized stories where people have cameras and things like that. But there are things happening every day across the country that people are not reporting on or don't have the film or the footage to get. But so yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, that's something we also have to talk about too, is not only violence that doesn't lead to murder against blacks, but also violence against black women. Mm-hmm. Something that I see as being a very big issue that a lot of the media has chosen to ignore.
Yeah. And I mean, black people are definitely taking the brunt of this, but I just want to let listeners know out there, it's not just black people that are getting abused by the police. So don't think you're immune. If you're not African American, don't think that you're not going to have the potential of getting abuse. I mean, it's happening to Native American people, mm-hmm. Latino people, and a lot of mainly poor white people.
Yeah, that number of 500, that includes everybody. That includes pretty much everybody anybody that's not part of the ruling class at this point. I would love to see those numbers broken down by class structure, and I guarantee you that at least 90% of them will be non-ruling class people, black, brown, red, yellow, or white people as
yep.
well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. indeed. Okay, I got a new story here. On the evening of June 6th, which is last week, about 900 people showed up for a rally to re-elect Socialist Alternative Seattle City Council woman Kashama Sawant. There were many speakers there, including progressive journalist Chris Hedges and Green Party former candidate for President Jill Stein. And there's a video of the whole event you can check out at YouTube. You can check that out. And also here in Illinois, Governor Bruce Rauner continues to push his so-called turnaround agenda around the state. Not been very successful. This week he made stops in Marion, Belleville, Quincy, Kelowna, Elk Grove Village, and Vernon Hills. The village of El Paso, you know where El Paso is, don't you, Bill?
Yeah, El Paso, it's on Route 51 heading up towards Bloomington.
Yeah, I think I was telling Gus, it's what, a biker bar, two churches, and some houses?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Okay. No. It's not as big as Hayworth.
Okay. But anyway, the village of El Paso, Illinois, and the city of Effingham have both taken consideration of the governor's turnaround general resolution off their agendas and will not be considered at their upcoming meetings this week. The village of Pontoon Beach in Madison County, I guess it's down by East St. Louis, passed a pro-middle class resolution unanimously at their June 9th meeting. And also June is usually the month in which the prevailing wage rates are adopted in each community. Three communities thus far that have voted to not adopt the prevailing wage rates are Woodstock, Oak Brook, and Stark County. And since it's a routine matter, it should be popping up on agendas all over the place. So stay tuned on that. But in general, Rauner's getting a few, you know, small little towns and counties. But for the most part, his little campaign isn't been getting much traction.
My home county of Piatt still has not recanted their vote in favor of his turnover program.
Basically trying to destroy prevailing wage rates.
Yeah, turn everything over, destroy prevailing wages, unions. Yeah.
I like that term too, turn over.
Yeah, instead of turn around.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of something better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Apple turnover. Gus, what else do you have?
Well, the military is getting ready to start, but they've already engaged in these urban warfare training programs. In Flint, Michigan, a couple of days ago, U.S. Army soldiers simulated assaults and set off explosives in neighborhoods in Flint, Michigan. And this was part of a 10-day urban warfare training exercise. And this was staged throughout the entire southeastern Michigan. But it was the people in Flint, Michigan who were told that, yeah, guess what? We're going to set off explosives around your neighborhoods and in different areas. So just be prepared for that. Yeah.
Wow. This is
I saw some video on that where basically a wing nut was approaching somebody who is military personnel dressed in civilian clothes, who is basically doing security to keep people away from the school where, during the video, two explosions went off. And basically what the idea is, it's sort of like Jade 15, which is coming up starting Monday, which we were hearing a lot about a couple of weeks ago. The idea of, probably maybe attacking Iran this time and having to deal with their urban centers.
Yeah.
Or something like that. I mean, they really screwed up in Iraq, you know, so they got to keep working on it. That's why they're doing Jade 15. It's desert territory.
Exactly.
You know, here they have kind of an urban area, a closed school, a building like situation.
Well, I think it's really ominous that they're having it in southeast Michigan, because let's not forget what's going on over in the, you know, eastern Michigan, in Detroit, in
exactly.
Flint, in Benton Harbor, where basically you've got there's no longer any democracy in those cities. I mean, basically the governor has suspended the mayor and elected mayor and city council, put it in his own quote-unquote emergency manager. And, I mean, these places are being, you know, the whole thing with the water shutoffs and stuff. And so, I mean, I don't find this a coincidence at all.
Of course not. And Detroit is now a ghost town at that fact. You have people saying that they go outside now and there are times where they don't see anybody in one of the biggest and most important cities in American history. And now it's a ghost town. But Chet, what we get now is we have people calling the police and complaining of gun battles that they hear outside their homes and find out, oh, it's the U.S. military doing that right outside their homes.
Yeah. You know, I talked to a woman, used to be on a city council, a couple weeks ago. Bill knows her. I won't mention her name. But, she said she, met some, young woman who was saying about her boyfriend who just got this really good paying job, over $100,000 a year. He's from Oakland, California. And she goes, oh, really? What's he doing? Well, he's on the, he moved to Detroit and he's on the team to quote unquote remake Detroit.
Remake Detroit.
I mean, the ruling class has got a plan for Detroit, and basically it's to push all the poor working class people out, and they want to basically, you know, pretty much gentrify it.
And that's what they did too. They pushed all the semi-skilled and decent wage labor jobs out of the city, and now they're making it into this big corporate network hub, especially when you're going to see a lot of those American car plants that are going to start disappearing more so as the years go on, to where they're just going to have an area where you can just network between each other to control all the different car parts and things being made overseas now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's in place now. It's not even the fact that there's something coming in the future. They're already getting ready now, and that's the remade thing that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's already there.
Yeah, and let's not forget, Detroit's right there on the on the border with Canada, right across the river from Windsor. So I mean, it's strategic, you know, as well as just a major city that used to be.
They could block the F-150s coming from Windsor. that's where my truck. I have an F-150. It's actually a foreign truck. It's made in Windsor.
Wow.
Okay.
Ontario. And that kind of goes into what happened this past week with President Obama's trade deal that got struck down a couple of days ago.
You beat me to the punch, Gus.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, that's a great lead-in. Yesterday, on Friday, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP, was dealt a very big blow in the U.S. House of Representatives. It's not totally clear what happens next, but the road to fast-tracking this massive corporate power grab will now be more difficult for corporate special interests than they're bought and paid for politicians. The TPP was pushed back yesterday for one simple, beautiful reason. That's people power. Labor unions, human rights organizations, internet freedom advocates, climate activists, and progressives all striped through their weight behind stopping this deal, and it's working, and we're starting to be heard. I guess there's massive amounts of phone calls to elected congressmen from all over the country, and there was big protests in Washington, D.C., so I guess a lot of Democrats and even some Republicans were feeling the heat on this. Anyway, it said that the TPTE is an example of the wealthiest 1% working together against the rest of us, and the setback for corporate special interests yesterday is a demonstration of the power we have when the rest of us work together to fight back. So stay tuned on that.
I was talking about this with Paul Muth, the host of the previous show. And basically what's going on with this issue is there's a lot of sloppy language. Because basically the TPP won. The TPP Fast Track Authority won, okay? But people don't say that. And what happened here was a situation to help mitigate the problems of people. I mean, a program to help mitigate the problems of people who would be laid off. That is something with due to the TPP. So what we really need to do is separate these things out. The fast track one, the thing to help people who might be harmed if TPP passes, lost because of some Democrats didn't think the provisions were good enough.
Well, this news to me, and I got to do some more research on this, but this is very alarming. That I mean, I saw I don't know how many emails.
Well, that people they just look at it and it's like, oh boy, you know. But we didn't really
exactly.
Well, that's bad. I mean, you can't. You shouldn't be putting.
I mean, that was all over my Facebook. You know, was people like thinking that way? I'm sorry, but I mean, that's what happened. It's kind of due to, and it's not. It's the media using sloppy language, you know, and confusing people.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's historic.
Okay. What else do you have, Gus?
There's a bit of an update going on in McKinney right now. Of course, everybody's talking about the major story, what happened with the young black girl. Well, guess what? Protesters took to the streets, in McKinney, in the hundreds. They say it got over to about almost 300-400 people in an outpouring of anger after the cell phone incident became viral. So what happened is that furious demonstrators blocked an intersection with their sit-in while they were chanting, "If we don't swim, you don't drive." And that's the kind of stuff I want to see.
I love it.
That should be happening across the country. Disruption leads to change. That's why you're having all these different stories coming out.
Well, yeah, civil disobedience, that disruption means a lot more than throwing some rocks through some windows.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, disrupting the everyday life. Well, throwing your body on the wheels of the machine. Well, that's basically what they just did.
Yeah, I mean, any type of rebellion, that's why you're having all these different indictments coming out now where they're like, well, I guess we got to indict. I'm not saying that they're going to convict,
but
the fact that people are starting to indict different police officers for these actions is because of the actions of the people doing these types of civil disobedience, having urban rebellions. That's a historic trend from the beginning of the 17th, 18th century when the people rally against something and consistently challenge their position, then you have change happening. And it has to remain consistent, because when you have those lulls in neoliberalism and right-wing conservatives come back into power, it's because we get too comfortable. We cannot get comfortable. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. We have to remain consistent.
Yeah. This brings back an interesting memory from Decatur during the Staley dispute, and they had this one big rally, and what they were going to do is strategically block intersections.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was the police had helicopters, so they were keeping track of where people were going.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was they just took type 2 barricades and blocked the intersections themselves.
Okay. That's good. So, Angela, what did you think about it? You saw that video that, 14-year-old girl being manhandled by that cop. I mean, what was your reaction when you saw that?
You know what? I don't condone that. I actually believe that they should have had woman police, because that's what they should do. You know, if there's a woman need to be handled, a woman police needs to handle her. I went through a situation like that with one of my daughters, and they end up saying that all they had was the police saying no, telling her to stop. So they unfounded it. He acted appropriately. But, okay, just like Gus said, though, if we don't stand up and go at these people about it, then, okay, we don't care, so they don't care.
Yeah.
So nothing's going to be done about it.
That's something, too. One of the major problems with this was there was a large number, you know, fairly large number of people and one guy. And instead of waiting for some other people to show up to help him out and possibly resolve this through conversation or something,
mm-hmm.
he just goes, you know,
berserk.
Half-cocked.
Yeah.
You know, and ends up almost, you know, what if his finger would have twitched and somebody would have got shot.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, pulling the gun.
Besides being angry, seeing him do that to that 14-year-old girl in a bikini bathing suit, no less, the fact that when those young men went up there, like saying, "Hey, what are you doing? What are you doing?" You know, I didn't hear what they said, but it's what it looked like they were doing. His response, he turns around and pulls his gun on him and chases him.
Well, he almost created a situation where he could say, I was in fear of my life.
Oh, yeah, that's the classic fallback, isn't
She's
it?
She's black. Yeah.
Now let's break this down a little bit more. Let's take this back into history now. Whenever there's an incident like this that involves children, this usually leads to something big on the horizon. We can go back and talk about the four little girls in Alabama. We can talk about Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are things that the Emmett Till situation sparked sparked the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. I argue. But, and now that, you know, when things happen with children, it's a different scope. And it's something that people like Franz Fanon had talked about. This is something that people like, Craig Calhoun has talked about. Different scholars have talked about when you go into a community and the community, especially in African American communities, because we have such a fondness for our children, raising them in a community style way, that when something happens to them, it really sparks a lot of different changes in the community.
As it well should.
In terms of organizing. Mm-hmm. So this is a historical precedent that's going on. So I'm thinking that something major is going to have to happen to resolve this issue. This is not going to go away anytime soon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. If we can't swim, you can't drive. Yeah. That is great. I mean, excellent. Excellent. Okay. Well, I got a little good news. I guess this is from Germany. I want to give you, you know, we like to do stories both locally, nationally, and, you know, also let you know a little bit what's going on in other countries here. And I guess this is off a labor, website here, and I guess what this person was reporting that lives in Germany said that the mood in Germany is to push for higher wages across the board. It's been building for the last couple years, and apart from some rather small craft groupings such as airline pilots and train drivers who are seeking to defend previous pay scale gains and stuff, there have been other, like metal workers fighting with warning strikes for over 5% pay raises, public service workers with various claims, and kindergarten teachers with a claim that want to have a 10% increase in their low pay, and they're conducting regional strikes. Salaried teachers, healthcare workers in Berlin, Amazon staff, and others have engaged in demonstrations and work stoppages. And on top of this, the Postal Service is seeking to impose worse paying conditions on private delivery services. The German Postal Service used to be totally public service, and then it was partially privatized along with the train service about 10 years ago, against the will of the majority of the people, I might add. But anyway, this provoked a series of regional strikes, which are ongoing. And they say here that strike ballots have been returned with 90% support by rank-and-file union members over the last year or so. And there is widespread public sympathy for the, I guess, militants, even to a good degree for the train drivers who held 9 strikes disrupting commuter travel and stuff here just in the last few months. So it's interesting. You know, a lot of people try to claim that Germany is such a, you know, wonderful, prosperous country. My wife's happened to be from Germany, and we hear reports occasionally from her cousins and friends. And, you know, people think about Germany a lot of times as back, you know, basically a view of it from the 70s and up into, you know, the mid-80s when they still had a lot of these hard-won benefits, you know, but there's been privatization through neoliberalism going on there now since the mid-80s, and, you know, it's gotten bad there, too, and people are wanting to start to fight back. You see the combination with what's been going on in Greece and Spain and Ireland and to a certain degree the UK, and you see in this phenomenon spreading all over the world. I mean, people are getting really tired, and they're getting fed up with this whole neoliberal system. For those people who aren't familiar with what neoliberalism is, basically it's a system of wealthy corporate elites trying to impose lower pay, worse conditions on us, trying to privatize all of our the commons, if you will, public goods like public schools, postal service, anything that belongs, you know, that to the that's a public service. They want to try to privatize it, you know, to where the taxpayers have to subsidize it so corporations can make a profit off of it.
And just to add in that, I think that that's an important fact that we don't really go into a lot of, because we always talk about neoliberalism. I hear people say it all the time. We should actually do a show where we actually break down the history of it and how it's transformed from the 80s to what's going on now, because there's been a big shift in how neoliberalism and the neoliberalization process works. So I would be happy to do that on one of the future shows.
Excellent.
That's one of the things I really study a lot of, because I think that is critical to understand the position of the worker in America and the world now.
Yeah, and, you know, liberal, you know, the term, I think a lot of people get confused, because a lot of people think liberal are those, you know, that they confuse, neoliberalism, they confuse it with the term, the traditional
this
use
is
of the term
neo-19th century liberalism, which has to do with trade policies and low tariffs, which
low wages and
relates on to conditions. Here. But,
this is not the same liberal of those people that want a better world. You know, that's
a
big difference.
It's not the one that you read in the dictionary or the one that George Washington referred to in that famous statement. But Dave, talking about Germany kind of segues into this really short thing from Talking Points memo by Aiza Garcia. Representative David Schweikert, who's a Republican from Arizona, said Friday during a House debate on Obama's free trade bill that made up stories and facts he was hearing about big labor would make Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels, quote, very proud.
Okay.
Schweikert said that he was compelled, quote, compelled to run down to the mic because he was, quote, enraged with the duplicity, unquote, he'd heard over, during the debate over Obama's Pacific Rim initiative to grant financial aid to displaced workers. That's a bill that we were talking about previously. Mm-hmm. Quote, some of the crazy things I'm seeing put out in the media by big labor, the willingness to make up stories, to make up facts, Goebbels would be very proud of them, Schweikert said. He went on to say, be careful that we're not getting conned by made-up stories. Yeah, he claims that NAFTA, we didn't lose any jobs because of trade deals NAFTA. That's all a big lie.
Who's putting out the lies and misinformation here, you know?
Wow.
Or is he really that stupid? I mean, I don't believe it, you know, that he's that stupid. So, anyway, we're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere. People on the stairs, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back. Junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far. Cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by, roaring as the breezes blow. A crazy lady living in a bag, eating out of garbage bales, used to be a fag hag. Such a dance, a tango, skipped the life and dango. A silk on princess seemed to lost her senses. Down at the peep show, watching all the creeps, so she could tell her stories to the girls back home. She went to the city and got so did it. She had to get a pimp, she couldn't make it on her own. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Okay, that was a song I thought might be appropriate from the 80s, Grandmaster Flash. Don't push me, I'm close to the edge. I think it's, I don't know if that's the actual title, but, you know.
The Any, legend.
Yes, yes, that's it. Thank you, Gus. So anyway, some public service announcements. The Prairie Green Party of Central Illinois will be having a meeting this Monday, June 15th at 7 p.m. at the downstairs conference room at the Urbana Public Library. We'll be discussing and voting on platform issues as well as electoral strategy for the 2016 elections. Labor's World, tune into the Labor's Worldview TV this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 and live at www.urbanapublictelevision.org. Tomorrow, tune in for the documentary Schmata, a documentary film about the destruction of the U.S. garment industry. And stay tuned for the two next Sundays in which we're going to be airing in two parts the film The Corporation, which if you haven't seen that, it's a very, very interesting, revealing film. And also we got here something as far as I guess the security. There's a petition here from CredoAction.org. Basically, the Security Exchange Commission, the federal agency responsible for enforcing securities laws and regulating Wall Street, is broken. President Obama's chair of that committee, Mary Jo White, is a big part of the problem. Just this week, the Project on a Government Oversight, a respected government watchdog group, sent a letter to President Obama requesting that he ask Mary Jo White to step down as chair of the SEC and designate a new head. This follows closely on the heels of a scathing 13-page letter Senator Elizabeth Warren sent directly to White. Senator Warren called out the SEC chair for refusing to move forward crucial rules, letting corporate criminal activity go unpunished, and even lying to the Senate about the status of pending regulatory matters. And anyway, it says it's time to tell President Obama loud and clear, no more business as usual. Mary Jo White needs to go. And you can sign that petition at CredoAction.org. So any public service announcements, guys, or... Okay, well, Gus, I guess let's hear about Atlanta.
What's not to be hear about Atlanta at this point? Atlanta is just, oh, well, the main topic for today we're going to be talking about, I told you all, is we're going to go into some public education and talk about Atlanta. You know, a lot of people have not heard a lot about what's going on with the cheating scandal, to be honest, because it was so spread out. It initially started in 2008, so-called, that the tests were taken, and they finally wrapped up the final sentencing for the people who were found guilty in 2015. So it's a long process. Those that know me know I taught in Atlanta public school system for 5 years while I was doing my master's. So it was an interesting experience. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give the history of the cheating scandal and put it into perspective of the issues going on with American education in general, because what you have going on is a privatization of education that started back in the late 1970s that came alongside neoliberalization process that's leading to what we're going to have is schools being based solely on making profit off of students, because what we want them to do, and this is a historical issue with education in America, is we want to create button pushers and public service low skill, low wage, no benefit workers to fulfill this the needs of the means of production. And that's the only reason that schools have ever existed in society. Let's go back to the 1800s. The only people who were allowed to go to school before the Civil War were the planter children. That was it. So you had 3 to 4% of the American children in this country that were allowed to go to school. It wasn't until after the Civil War when black people started building public school centers that all the groups of different, especially lower class whites, started going to school as well.
So this happened in Reconstruction.
Yeah, this was during Reconstruction when they actually said, you know what, we're going to start allowing more children to go to school and not just the select few, which is what they were doing. So now, so when they opened the floodgates and you had the Horace Manns and the other reformers come in and say, let's make schools better for all people, what they pretty much did was basically make a very succinct and slow, and I won't say slow, I'll say gradually evolving education that only allow people to get to a certain point. You're not allowed to actually critically think about things unless you have that teacher or you have that space or that group of people that you run into, because the system is set up for you to only get to a certain point and then move you on so that you can fulfill a job as a low skill, low wage worker. Okay. And that's the way it's been going. Now, the school I taught in at Benjamin E. Mace High School, a lot of people like to think of Atlanta as being this middle class elite haven and the spot for black business and all this stuff. 75% of my students were free and reduced lunch. And that's how it is in the majority of Atlanta. So, you know, the working class still, in terms of wages and in terms of who, in their class structure, still controls Atlanta in terms of population size. Mm-hmm. So the middle class is still very small there. So when people who all think that it's supposed to be this mythology of black Atlanta being this great thing, that's only because there's more black people there, but they're still suffering under the issues of capitalism and racism though. So what happened is that, and a lot of people don't really know this history, but it's really interesting to put it into this perspective, that back in 2008, they took the test called the CRCT in the middle school and elementary schools in the Atlanta public school system. And what those tests are supposed to show is if you've learned anything while at that particular grade level. So this is 2008-2009 school year. I started teaching in 2009 at Mace High School. So nobody heard anything about anything. But in 2010, after the superintendent at the time, Beverly Hall, who just passed, she had won superintendent of the year for the entire country. So she was recognized as being the one that brought Atlanta public school system to being one of the best urban public school systems in the country. So that same year, there was this major thing that came out from the governor's office, at the time, Sonny Perdue, one of the most racist.
Sonny Perdue,
one of the most racist conservative people you will ever meet in terms of a governor. He actually comes out and says that there are 191 schools across the state where they found evidence of tampering on answer sheets for the state standardized testing. Now pay attention to what I said. Across the state, 191 schools. And the order came from the governor's office. So what they actually even said, to even make this more ridiculous, from a quote, this is the biggest erasure problem I've ever seen. A testing expert from the University of North Carolina said, this doesn't suggest that it was just kids randomly changing their answers. It suggests a pattern of unethical behavior on the part of either kids or educators. Now, that was 191 schools in Georgia. But what was the only school system that was charged with and made this into a national phenomenon? The Atlanta public school system. Here's why. In 2010, Beverly Hall went to the governor, and she was one of the only superintendents in the state to say that this was false. Nobody cheated and nobody did anything. Everything is wrong. So other counties like Cobb County Schools, Douglas County Schools, Fulton County Schools, all these different Henry County Schools, all these different schools, they had major erasure problems. Some were worse than Atlanta's. What they did was they just acquiesced, and they actually went in, they appeased the governor, fired a couple of people, and then they cleaned it up in-house.
Yeah, Cobb County, now that's the county just north of the city of Atlanta, big mm-hmm. suburban county, pretty well-off people live up there, right?
Yeah.
Plus some rural parts as well.
No, you're right, and that's one place that, black people, we usually don't try to go to at night because the Cobb County police are something else. So those of you that are listening that are from Atlanta, those that are from land know about Cobb County police already. I don't have to say anything. But going back into the story, mm-hmm. Atlanta, Beverly Hall stands up and is one of the only educators, a very proud African-American woman, and she stands up to this governor who is very condescending and paternalist and saying, no, you're wrong. We did no cheating whatsoever. That never happened. So the very next year, not even a year, I think it was only maybe 3 to 4 months when all of a sudden federal investigators burst through her office and took her computers. And we're talking about, see, and now we're at the point, now let me give you some more numbers. this thing got so bad that it turned into 44 schools now from Atlanta Public School System out of the 191 that were charged with cheating that became the national Atlanta Public School cheating scandal. So the question remains, what happened to the other school systems in Georgia? Why was Atlanta put on the radar? That we have to dig deeper than it was just educators and students erasing answers and all this other stuff. This goes into a historical issue in terms of race, gender, and class that has been crippling education in America. This black woman stood up and said, we didn't do this. You're wrong. And he went after her.
Do you think she might have also been, what's the term, the threat of a good example? In the sense that,
exactly.
She did so well that, not only, she'd African American woman, but also I'm wondering if they didn't have plans to start doing some massive privatization in the Atlanta school districts. They couldn't very well do it if Atlanta had improved their scores so significantly, because they've always got to use excuse, well, it's a failing school and, we need to privatize it, Do you think that's part of it too?
Oh, definitely. And what's funny about that is you have, what was I going to say? Because you hit it right on the nail. I forgot what I was going to say with it. But yeah, that's exactly right though. There is a privatization going on in the school system, not to mention that this happened right around time that charter schools really became a very big vocal point throughout the city at the time.
Okay.
So this is something that's going big.
So she made their plans very inconvenient. Let's put that.
Yeah. Of course. And like I said, just being a scapegoat for things that are going on at the state level. There are issues throughout the entire state and throughout the entire country with testing and cheating and erasures. It happens everywhere. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, if federal investigators went to every system in the country, they would see it happening, because there's so much pressure on administrators, on teachers, and on students to perform well on a bunch of tests that don't mean anything. You can teach the student what's going to be on the test in a 2-week time span and they would pass it still. It doesn't mean they've learned anything.
Right.
There's no critical thinking on these tests. I administered these end of the course tests, and like I said, the students will always tell me, all I had to do was come to your tutorial sessions and I passed it. It was that easy. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really measure. In fact, it's a kind of punch in the face to real educators who go in and spend the whole year trying to actually have their students critically think to get this test that's like fifth grade level at for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's the kind of thing that we're dealing with across the country at this point.
Now, testing, it's a big industry, isn't it?
It's a huge industry. They're privatizing testing now, and now that they're going into this Common Core mess, and then soon they're going to start the national testing that Obama was talking about soon, which is going to be a huge violation of the Constitution doesn't mean anything anyway at this point. But it's going to be violating the fact that the state governments are going to stand up, and they're going to say, wait a minute, you're getting too close into what we do as the Ninth Amendment says. We're the ones that take care of education. So by doing these national standards and these national testing thing, there's going to be a bit of an issue between the executive power versus the state powers. So it's going to be kind of an interesting battle going on here. But the point is that testing is rampant throughout the country now, and it doesn't do anything but prepare students for low wage and low skill work, and the teachers are the ones who become the scapegoats for the administration and the privateers.
Hey, back in the 60s and 70s, when I was in grade school and high school, we'd have these tests like National Merit Scholar or something like that. And they were like some kind of national test, but basically about all they were kind of bragging rights.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like your school was. Yeah, it's really weird. I mean, it was widespread, I believe, and people would brag if they did well. Schools would brag possibly
but there was no
if they well. But yeah, it wasn't like there was a funding involved or anything like that, and possibly it was a truer gauge
mm-hmm.
of how things were going. And then I read about these tests where they have some kind of, they're adaptive. Mm-hmm. And the better you do on the test, it adapts to make it harder.
Hmm. Yeah, we have that for the G. The GRE has that.
Well, and something that I see too is just these huge numbers of like, take any school system, it'll be like, oh, 36% of the people are going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
They
predict that, and therefore they try to self-fulfill prophecy.
Well, to me, if you got a test that 36% of the people are going to fail. I mean, fail, then that means you don't have a very good instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And let's
because it should be over a standard range, you know, the standard curve.
And let's not even forget the fact that you had these new integrated math programs being put into Atlanta Public Schools at the time that they had no textbooks for. So you
what?
No textbooks. I'm serious. The math teachers in my school, they were literally just so stressed out and so just that because they could not do things with their students because there were no textbooks, there were no resources to teach this so-called integrated math. They got rid of geometry, they got rid of trigonometry, they got rid and they just got math 1 and math 2 and math 3. It doesn't even really have a definition, doesn't have a standard. It was kind of a go as you show type thing, and then they would give them a state test at the end of the course without having given the teachers the resources to help the students understand something that is brand new out the bag. Nobody integrated math is, especially in schools predominantly African-American where the resources are not there to learn about those kind of things.
Sounds like it was almost set up to fail.
Of course. And that's the big thing. And just to go into this major, back to the story of the issue is No Child Left Behind. And that's the big thing that, of course, Bush brought in 2001. It became law. And what it did was it fundamentally altered education in Georgia and around the country. And what No Child Left Behind does is it uses high stakes testing to create accountability.
So-called
accountability for student progress and test scores. And it's enforced by allotments of federal funding. So, and again, that we already got constitutional violations all over the place by that point.
If the school does badly, they lose funding.
Of course. Yeah.
When they should be getting more funding to bring up the test scores.
Exactly. But if you do well, then not the teachers get a small little, what's it called? A bonus in their checkbook. But the administrators and the board members, we don't know how much money they got. That was always disclosed information. But just going back to this, Georgia was doing so poorly in this task using the 2009 CRCT that it received a waiver to use its own standard for evaluating schools, the College and Career Ready Performance Index. Now, here's where things get tricky. Even by this index, the College and Career Ready Performance Test, Georgia schools were still failing. At the same time Georgia schools faced new federal requirements based on test scores, they were confronting budget cuts. Always at the state level. And the first thing that the capitalists always do that when they want to cut something in the state house is they cut education. So more than $8.3 billion has been cut from public school funding since 2003. During the same period, the number of low-income students in Georgia public schools increased from 44% to 62%. And when I finished actually and left, it was up to past the 70% range.
Wow.
So, as if the high-stakes testing policies within No Child Left Behind weren't punitive enough, in 2010, APS, my school system, won a $400 million grant for this thing called reform under President Obama, and you all heard of it as Race to the Top. So getting the funding required the state to impose merit pay on teachers so students' performance on tests not only determined the financial status of schools, but was directly linked to teachers' paychecks. So in other words, you were either... If you were not tenured, then you weren't getting a contract the next year if your students didn't do well enough on their testing. And if you did get a so-called raise in the student scores, it would usually be like 1 to 2%, then you got a bump in your paycheck. So that's the so-called Race to the Top thing. And it was a huge failure on every count. And we never hear President Obama talk about that. And he never goes back to the Race to the Top in one of any of his major speeches because it was such a colossal failure and that schools are now regressing in Atlanta public school system and Georgia as a whole and, of course, across the nation.
Mm-hmm. You know, just the general thing about financing, and I think back that, you know, in the 60s and at least in the early 70s, it's not through the entire decade, I didn't hear about people having fundraisers for things having to do with schools because about everything that had to do with school was paid for.
Yeah, federal revenue sharing.
Right, and also much higher state funding also and probably fairer.
Mm-hmm.
And then it started about in the 80s when I started hearing about people having their bake sales for their cheerleaders and you know, they have to raise money to take buses to the wrestling tournament or whatever the heck it was and the band and everything else. And, it just embarrasses me and shames me that we live in a nation where they have completely just lost the whole idea of any, fair, distribution of the material wealth and income of the country unlike it used to be.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what happened when they screwed the income tax system. And really, as, let's say Tom Hartman says, we need to repeal the Reagan tax cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also like to repeal the Reagan tax raise on the payroll tax, which doesn't go to pay for schools, or it doesn't even go to school teachers.
Yeah.
Because they don't get Social Security in most situations. You know, they're government employees.
Oh, I can go deeper into that.
Yeah, and, you know, but I mean, what it just illustrates is how far gone this country has come from a more equitable system.
Yeah.
At least economically.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like it's all part of an agenda here, basically, to try to make, education, healthcare, you know, all sorts of other things that used to be considered, a part of a decent country, you know, for the welfare.
That's just it.
Yeah.
Right.
That they're trying to make those luxuries as opposed to human rights.
Mm. Right. Well, I mentioned Tom Hartman, and he quite often mentions an interview he saw, like on one of the business TV channels or something, with a German gazillionaire of some sort or another.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the interviewer just kept trying to bring up the high taxes he paid in Germany.
Yeah.
And finally, the guy says, "Look, you know, I don't mind paying those taxes. I'd rather be a rich person in a rich country than a rich person in a poor country."
Yeah. Yeah, the crime rate for one. I mean, you know, that's just one item among many.
And your chauffeur can't miss all the potholes in the road.
Yeah, either. That's true too. Okay, we're going to take a real quick music break. We'll be right back. Listening to World Labor on WFT, Listeners First Community Radio Station. Okay, we're back at World Labor Hour. So, okay, Gus and Angela here. I'll let Gus talk a little bit more. He's going to answer my question here on education, and then Angela's going to, talk a little bit too on this topic.
So, just to finish off what's going on in Atlanta, everybody knows by now. Well, if you don't, then this is what happened. They investigated Atlanta school, public schools became the only school system that was charged with this major national scandal. All the other school systems did it quietly, and it went away. So, you ended up having 178. People that were brought in, they ended up 30 teachers and a few other administrators were charged. Some of the charges range from some of the charges range from 7 years. I mean, excuse me. Some of the sentencing after being found guilty range from 7 years in prison plus like 13 years of probation, along with 2,000 hours of community service, a $25,000 fine. I mean, just different things like that. Yeah.
So what, did these people have really bad criminal records before this?
Oh, of course not.
Are these a lot of first offenders?
First offenders, and they were charged RICO. Now they have a RICO charge on their personal, like.
This is felony.
Yeah, the RICO charge, the same thing that they charge things with Al Capone, the organized crime and mafia families. They charged with, teachers who were told by administrators.
Union officials.
who were told by administrators that they would likely lose their jobs or if they didn't appease this cheating scandal. So the question is now, what does this mean? What does this mean not just for Atlanta public schools, but what does this mean for education moving forward as we go along in the second decade of the 21st century? The big thing that we're now having, of course, is what some people are calling the educational industrial complex now. The entire educational sector now represents nearly 9% of the U.S. GDP. So merger and acquisition activity in for-profit education, especially in the year 2013 surpassed activity at the peak of the internet boom.
Really?
Yes. So here's the big one that's going on. Here's the big one. Just as the major corporation in educational material business, which covers everything from curriculum, textbooks, homework materials, standardized testing, this field is increasingly dominated by this corporation called Pearson, the British company that made $5 billion in revenue in 2013. So in states like New York, Pearson has already gotten contracts to provide curriculum tests and teacher certification exams and creating a closed loop without accountability, as education writer Alan Singer explained when the contracts were being signed in 2012. Listen to this quote. Pearson standardized exams will assess how well teachers implement Pearson instruction modules and Pearson's Common Core standards, but not what students really learn or whether students are actually learning things that are important to know, meaning no critical thinking.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Well, I believe that every child deserves an education, and I believe that if the administrators and teachers aren't, the kids aren't making progress, they need to reevaluate the administrators and the teachers and just the people higher up, because that they're keeping them at a level, and then if it's made hard for them, then they'll get frustrated, then, you know, all these dropouts, you know, and then they won't succeed in life. But it's like the glass ceilings I learned in sociology class. They want to keep us at a level, but I mean, education is crucial to our future because of the children. You know, the kids are our future. We're all older now, but you know, they just need to reevaluate. I believe they need to get a whole new House of Representatives and Senate, because the Constitution, the stuff in the Constitution right now is not even being, it's not being done.
Yeah, it's not, it doesn't mean much anymore.
It doesn't. Yeah. So, I mean, why do we have it, and why do we have to follow it if they're not doing what they need to do?
Well, like I said, the big thing that, the whole thing I wanted people to take from this is that education historically has always been underfunded, underrepresented, and also exploitable to the people that work in it and the people who actually go through it. It has never been a system that has allowed people in America to critically think and to actually progress to a point to where they can do whatever they actually want. It was never designed to be that. The status quo of American education is to create a labor force to supply the means of production. That's the only issue, and the only way that we're going to change that, and we're going to stop these private groups like Pearson going in and just focusing solely on their products and their selling, is to restructure the system. We have to continue to show people and explain these things and actually have protests, not just with police brutality, but also what are we doing with our education system? Because like you say, education is the one thing I believe, and that most people from the left believe, is the one thing that can really lead to a serious revolution. When people are educated and knowledgeable about their conditions and their social forces, they will change them. And that's why education is so tightly controlled.
Yeah, and I mean, it's most, you know, I mean, like, for instance, in every European country I know, at least Western European countries, you know, education is totally free from preschool, daycare, all the way up to the PhD level, as long as you have the grades. Here in the United States, in California, it used to be free in the state of California up until sometime in the 80s. And it used to be real common to be able to get Pell Grants and other grants to go to school.
Well, you used to be able to live on almost going to school. Yes. I mean, like in my career in the building trades, if things got slow or I had my driver's license revoked or something, you know, go back to school. But something I would say, I was talking about this being sort of a dumbing down of people so that they can just fit into the cogs of the factory, you know. Mm-hmm. Ironically, public education was really pressed for by the labor movement in the United States historically. And it's just, and also too, it's just, there's just been, you know, so much inequity, you know, depending on where you lived, and this ridiculous property tax based system of funding anything.
Yeah, as opposed to what should be done, which is a progressive income tax. You know, tax the wealthy, tax the corporations. I mean, that's who needs. They're the ones with the money.
Yeah, I don't even see why you have property taxes on a local level. It's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to hire somebody to go around and try and figure out what all of this stuff is worth, when all you have to do is every W 2 I get has a blank on there for a local income tax if anybody would ever want to do it. And it would be so much easier. God, you get rid of the assessors, and it'd be so much fairer.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, now it's...
I like, you know, that's a
property
really,
tax. Oh, yeah, I got my bill the other day.
Sorry. One thing you said, Gus, which really I think is a profound statement, is imagine to where... of society, to where all education was free, you know, from preschool daycare to the PhD level, and people could do what they want to do. I mean, what a concept.
That's huge. And that's why I honestly believe that based on why education has been so tightly controlled. And like we talked about earlier, why were only a set number of people allowed to be in education for the majority of this country's history from 1607 or 16, whatever. Don't, my old students that are listening, don't hate me. I know I was big on 1607. But from 1607 to 1865, the majority of Americans were not allowed to go to school. Planter children went. Other children worked in the farms and worked in different factories and different trades. So again, you go into this now. When we finally start making public education accessible to all people, how are we going to do it? We're going to let the state control what goes on in the curriculum. And we know the state governments have always been the most racist and the most regressive and the most conservative parts of the U.S. government. And they're the ones that control the curriculum and the funding and all this other stuff. And then the federal government, now that we have the right turn with the Reaganites in the 80s and moving on with neoliberalism, now you have the state government and the federal government working together to regress education to where No Child Left Behind became this monster that really hurt people. And it's all people.
Ideally, how do you think it should be done?
How education should be done?
Well, like you were talking about, you know, control of it. I mean,
it has to be free. It has to be community based. It has to be free. Mm-hmm. I cannot remember the year, but in New York, there was an African American community that was allowed to run their own community school. And I think it was in 72 or 73. I can't remember what year it was. And I know somebody listening might know it, but they let them run it for a year and it was widely successful. The teachers, the students, everybody was doing great things, but then there was some issue with other neighborhoods around the space. And I can't really go into it. That should be another show too. About that actually happening, because that was the time when it was very successful when the community ran their schools. Okay. And I mean, that has to be the way things are done. But the only way we're going to be able to get to that point is by restructuring the system. We can't just go in and try to do it because something's going to happen to where the capitalists or the ruling class are going to break it apart like they did the school in New York.
Yep.
We have to restructure the entire system in this country.
Okay, Angela, any last words on this?
Oh, yeah. And education that I see as kids are in like middle school and going forward, parents are a big, they are an important role in that as well, because you have kids that, like, I went to the school once and I was going to, my daughter was doing really good, so I wanted to go and acknowledge that. There was another child there and she was like, well, I wish my mom would come. You know, the parents aren't involved there because they're too busy out. Okay, you're drinking, you're smoking, but this is why DCFS gets involved in people's lives, because they should. Because parents play an important role. If your parent doesn't encourage you and check on you and what you know, your work and everything, then you're like, okay, well, my mom or dad doesn't care, so I don't care. So now that leaves room for error, you know?
Well, let me challenge that a bit, because we have to go back into history now why blacks especially are not as involved in children's lives to this day. We have to look at the political economy of what's going on in the country now. There are so many low-skill, low-wage jobs at this point, and especially after the Great Recession. So people are getting jobs where they have to work all day and night, and then that's not enough to even pay rent in these skyrocketing, the increasing rents and living situations in these cities. So you have to get 2 or 3 jobs sometimes. I had students where some of their parents had 3 jobs, and they could not come around. They didn't have clothes. They didn't have things. So yeah, that does happen somewhere where there are a few parents that are doing well and they're not in their children's lives. But on the most part, we have a very oppressed group of people who cannot. They don't have the ability to be in their children's life because of what's going on economically and because of the job situation. Yeah, I mean, it's horrible.
I think these are 2 very good points here. I mean, because, you know, for a child to succeed, I mean, the parents have to encourage them and stuff. And if the parents aren't able to do that, I mean, because they're working too much or whatever.
Yeah, but that's why I said they need to get a whole new group of people to see about these things, because you should be able to go to work as well as take at least maybe give them an hour or two, go and, you know, see your child as well. I mean, you can't leave your child out because you have to work. I mean, there's got to be a balance there.
Yeah.
Well, beyond that, I mean, when it gets to the point where people's children don't get the proper nutrition,
yeah, that too.
The ability to sleep well at night for one reason or another, neighbors, maybe the air conditioner's broke, you know, it's way beyond, something like that. I mean, it's way beyond what teachers can do.
Well, sure.
You know, sure. And it's just this whole society needs to be concerned about it.
Yes, indeed, indeed.
And then one of the big things too that we have to look at in terms of what's going on with that, it's the school systems that are part of this too. In my school system, they were very clear in that if a parent comes to the office to see their children, that the teacher go to the office to speak to the parent. They were cutting off parent access to teachers. So,
really?
So the parents that actually wanted to be in the classroom, they were telling them, no, because, you know, they were for safety reasons, which is complete crap. There was they never had no issue going on in the Atlanta public school system where parents, well, there were a couple of issues, but that was outside the school. That wasn't actually inside the building, and I could do another show on that.
Okay.
But my point is that the parents were not allowed to come into the classrooms to be with their students or to see what was going on and be a part of the learning environment. That happens a lot in public education now, especially in those areas like Atlanta and black communities. And that's a problem. So even the parents that want to be involved and have the time, they're getting restricted. And the same thing's happening in Chicago. Ruby Mendenhall in the University of Illinois is doing a study on this. And the parents say the same thing. Like they're upset. Like, I can't even go and sit in my child's class and see how they're doing. I can't be a part of that environment. So again, this is something that is a lot deeper than just, it's not as simple as, there's something going on here the way, so you don't want the parents involved, but when the conservatives only say, well, the parents aren't there, that they're fatherless children and stuff, but when they try to get there, they restrict them. So again, there's a systemic problem going on here.
And one more thing, we have things like fatherless children, so on and so forth. If you have a media and an establishment that uses every voice to say over and over and over and over again that you're going to have problems because you don't have a father there in the household, well, I think it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah,
you
I'm
just
sure.
keep telling the kid that over and over and over.
Yeah, and back to the other issue. I mean,
exactly.
What a society this would be if somebody, I mean, why should anybody have to work more than 8 hours a day? 5 days a week, six 6 hours a day or
4 days a week.
Yeah, whatever.
To keep the rich richer and the poor
poor.
Yeah.
Why do we have to work so many hours?
The 4 hour day back during a terrible recession in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, you think about, let's try to think about a future advanced civilization, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, wouldn't that be what we should be striving for as opposed to trying to go back to the 1890s or, you know, beyond that? Well, we're going to run out of time here, but the real interesting show.
Where's my jetpack?
Okay. All right. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour. This is Support Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned for the Union Edge. And until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.